7 December 1941, President Roosevelt said, "It's the date that will live in infamy because of the Sunday morning attack on Pearl Harbor." I'm Oliver North, and this War Stories podcast is a tribute to those who sacrificed and served in one of the most overlooked chapters of World War II history. U.S. bases in Hawaii weren't the only American military installations attacked by the Japanese on 7 December 41. Just hours after the bombing in Hawaii, the enemy began attacking U.S. forces in the Philippines. All but unnoticed, the Japanese also set their sights on 1,600 American Marines and contractors located in three tiny specks of coral 2,000 miles west of Honolulu, known as Wake Island. In the 1930s, Wake was an important fueling stopover on long flights between Hawaii and the Far East. Pan American Airlines built a luxurious hotel there for passengers flying aboard their new Clipper aircraft. Meanwhile, in Tokyo, Japanese Imperial war planners decided they needed the tiny atoll as an unsinkable airbase. They expected only feeble resistance from 350 Marines of the 1st Defense Battalion and the 1,200 civilian contractors stationed on the island. The Japanese were dead wrong. For over 2 weeks, the Marines and contractors under the command of Major James Devereaux outmaneuvered and outfought the enemy. In this podcast, you'll hear from Jack Skaggs and Ewing LaPorte as they recount battles that handed the Japanese their first tactical defeat in World War II. Their victory was fleeting. The Japanese, under the command of Admiral Kajioka, returned with an armada of over 40 ships. The small American garrison, battling incredible odds, was forced to surrender the island. In the aftermath, the Wake Island defenders became the first American prisoners of war in the brutal hands of the Japanese captors. For a stunned nation, the heroic 2-week defense of Wake Island was the only good news in those early days of the war. FDR paid tribute to their fighting spirit and inspired Hollywood's first World War II movie, Wake Island. In this podcast episode, you'll meet the legendary defenders of Wake Island. If you're hiring, you know that quality hires keep your business moving forward, but you also know it can take a lot of time to find the right candidate for the right job. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job on over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click, so you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then, ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results. And right now, my listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/strive. That's ZipRecruiter.com/strive. One more time, get it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/strive.
Welcome to War Stories. I'm Oliver North, and we're here at the National Museum of the Pacific War in Fredericksburg, Texas. Within hours of their 7 December 1941 surprise attack on Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were swarming across the Western Pacific, attacking American installations in China, the Philippines, and Guam. They also set their sights on three tiny specks of coral, 2,000 miles west of Honolulu, known as Wake Island. The atoll, occupied by a small contingent of U.S. Marines, a handful of soldiers and sailors, and about 1,000 civilian contractors, looked like an easy target to the Japanese. They were dead wrong. Outgunned and outnumbered, the beleaguered defenders of Wake Island battled back, ashore and in the air, for 16 days against Imperial Japan. Tonight, meet some of those brave men who took on the might of Japan, the heroes of the battle for Wake Island. In late 1936, Pan American Airways Clippers, mammoth and luxurious 26-ton flying boats, began ferrying their wealthy clientele across the Pacific from San Francisco to the Orient and Australia. Needing to refuel along the way, one of their stops was a tiny atoll 2,000 miles west of Hawaii called Wake Island.
Well, they did have a hotel there, the Wake Island Hotel of Pan American.
John Wukowitz is the author of Pacific Alamo, The Battle for Wake Island.
People would come out and enjoy great food at the hotel, and then spend the rest of the day in their stopover walking around and realizing there's not a heck of a lot on this place.
That's putting it mildly. Wake had been a U.S. possession since the end of the Spanish-American War in 1899. But until Pan Am built its fuel stop and hotel, the atoll, comprised of Wake, Peel, and Wilkes Islands, had long been just barren specks of coral in a vast Pacific Ocean.
Wake is the furthest American possession to the west in the Pacific.
It's almost like it was the Wild West, a Fort Apache of the water wilderness.
But as Japanese aggression in the Pacific became more threatening to the U.S., President Franklin Roosevelt recognized that Wake's location was crucial to protecting the Hawaiian Islands from Japanese attack.
There was a conglomeration of huge American construction companies, including Morris and Knudsen, that were assigned to develop bases at Wake and Guam and other places in the Pacific.
Morris and Knudsen had been instrumental in the construction of the Hoover Dam and San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. The first contractors began arriving on Wake in January 1941.
How did you end up working for Morris and Knudsen out in the Pacific?
Morris and Knudsen's main office was on Broadway here in Boise. We heard that the salary there was about three times what it was in the States.
22-year-old Idaho native Darwin Dar Dodds couldn't wait to head out to the Pacific.
I arrived on Wake Island Easter Sunday, April 13th, 1941. It looked like a desolate place. The highest place on that island was 14 feet above sea level. So I knew one big wave and you're gone.
There were 1,145 approximately civilian construction workers. Basically your average Joe looking for adventure, maybe make a little bit of money.
Also lured out to Wake was 20-year-old Joe Goicoechea from Boise, Idaho.
Did anybody ever tell you, Joe, that this place was vulnerable to attack by the Japanese?
Oh, we didn't think that. We were thinking about getting rich. I was going to become a millionaire.
What were the civilian construction workers building?
They were building the base facilities there. They would be building the airstrip.
Sent to shore up Wake's defenses by Pacific Fleet Commander Admiral Husband Kimmel, was a 38-year-old Marine Major, James P. Devereaux.
In October 41, Major Devereaux came out with a detachment of Marines. His orders had been to build up the defenses. He said, you know, I don't have an awful lot. What am I supposed to do if war comes? And the response was, do the best you can.
The strict and meticulous new commander brought a sense of urgency to the 550 military personnel stationed on the atoll.
There were six Army personnel, and then the other were Navy personnel operating the seaplane area. Approximately 500 were Marines.
Devereaux had those Marines going round the clock, sandbagging, getting everything going.
The Marines and contractors worked together for long days in the scorching sun. But when each day was done, their lives were very different.
We had two mess halls.
Did the Marines eat in either one?
No, Marines, no. They treated them a little different.
The food, first of all, made the Marines drool with envy.
We had real eggs, real cantaloupe, real beefsteak. The food was absolutely beautiful.
Even the Marines at Wake weren't concerned before war started. If there was going to be any trouble in the Pacific, everybody assumed it would be the Philippines or somewhere in the Far East.
But the commander of the Japanese combined fleet, Admiral Yamamoto, thought otherwise. Strategically, Wake Island could serve as a stepping stone for attacking the American-held islands of Hawaii and Midway. For Yamamoto, Devereaux's undermanned Wake Island was a must-have.
Devereaux has how many 5-inch guns?
Six 5-inch guns. 12 3-inch guns, and 24 machine guns.
That's it.
Only half of which were manned because he didn't have enough Marines.
As construction of the base progressed, Navy Commander Winfield S. Cunningham arrived to take overall command of the island.
He technically was in charge of everything, but Devereaux took care of the defenses manned by the Wake Marines.
On 4 December, 12 Grumman Wildcats of Squadron VMF 211 arrived to provide a very sparse air defense over Wake. One of VMF 211's pilots was 27-year-old Lieutenant John Kinney, a former Pan Am mechanic.
We had 12 planes altogether. We've been flying about a month.
On the morning of 7 December 1941, 8 December on Wake Island, which is west of the international date line, word spread quickly that Yamamoto had unleashed a devastating surprise attack on Pearl Harbor.
They do get some warning. They know when Pearl Harbor is bombed that we're at war.
Yeah.
And yet, the only thing that's done to basically prevent their entire little air force of 12 airplanes from disappearing at once is to keep four of them aloft.
They sent out four on search missions, scouting missions. The other eight were on the ground.
On the morning of the attack, we were headed towards the Marshall Islands.
None of the four ever sighted the Japanese.
I was getting ready to go to lunch. We had heard earlier that Honolulu was attacked, and we poo-pooed it.
They said Pearl Harbor was hit. The guy said, oh, no, they'd never bomb us.
But at around noon that day, all hell broke loose on Wake Island.
From the sun over the airport, you see all these black things dropping.
What's going through your head at that point?
Confused, completely. They hit the airport. The guys are still in the cockpits. They got hit, and quite a few of them got killed right there.
I mean, it was frightening. That island is terribly small. One echelon came in over Pan Am and completely destroyed it. The other one came in over our airstrip, got those planes on the ground, and just made a mess out of everything out there.
The bombs are dropping all around you. Gee whiz, your head was rattling. I mean rattling.
After days of devastating bombing attacks, the next assault came from the sea. But this time, Devereaux and his men were ready. That's next on War Stories.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage. The Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya, Guam, the Philippine Islands. The Japanese attacked Wake Island.
As the Japanese were wreaking havoc elsewhere in the Pacific, Lieutenant John Kinney was 12,000 feet in the air, flying due south in one of four Wildcats on a recon mission. He was unaware that 36 enemy planes passed a half mile below him, flying north to bomb Wake Island.
We didn't know that that had happened until we got back on the ground. When we got back, the whole island was in flame. The planes had been shot up. The mechanics had been killed.
The men on Wake Island were basically without defense facilities that could reach out and strike the Japanese.
First of all, I think everybody's in kind of a state of shock. And for the first time, they realized that this was a different thing. This was a do or die.
And do they did. Missouri native Ewing LaPorte dug in while manning his 50 caliber anti-aircraft gun. Commander Winfield Scott Cunningham and Marine Major Jim Devereaux and all the Leathernecks on Wake knew the Japanese would return.
They came back the next day. Second day was same time. They started bombing the 5-inch 51 batteries areas.
For 2 days after the first attack, 19-year-old Private First Class Jack Skaggs stood ready for the Japanese from his position at L Battery on Wilkes Island.
They hit us every day in the daytime. And like I say, you could almost set your watch at 11:30. From the original day, we knew where they were coming from. Our fighter planes, VMF 211, would have four planes up scouting for them. And when they spotted them, they called in their altitude. And so anti-aircraft did pretty well.
So it became a pretty hardened group right off the bat. Of the 1,450 civilians, how many volunteer to take up arms?
It would be somewhere between 400 and 450 did something to help out in some way. Even before the war started, they had gone over and trained with some of the Marines to learn how to operate some of the guns. Then when war came, these civilians were there to assist the Marines.
We volunteered. We had no choice. Our project manager, he gave a speech, and he said, you're going to have to go out in the brush and every man for himself.
Marines could assign us wherever they wanted us to go. They didn't have enough men, the machine guns and the anti-aircraft and the 5-inch. They had to depend on the civilians.
Major Devereaux was very wise in thinking, the Japanese are flying over, they'll spot where my 3-inch guns are now, they'll tell from the next bombing attack where it is, so I've got to move them.
And we moved those big guns every night and left the parapet up so it would look like it was still there, and then filled sandbags and carried ammunition you wouldn't believe.
These planes were there to soften it up, to find out what was there, you know, a little bit of reconnaissance as well. And then on December 11th, just as one of the Japanese said, it'll be a cakewalk.
What's the first inkling they get that an invasion is about to take place?
When they spotted some ships at sea, some lights out at sea.
I was on duty with a corporal. It was late in the evening, and we just made out these two ships moving along, and looked like ghost ships.
But what Skaggs saw was very real. The apparitions were part of a Japanese armada of 14 ships under the command of Rear Admiral Sadamichi Kajioka. Their plan? Storm ashore and take the island.
Major Devereaux decided there's no way we can fight off any kind of a large force. The only thing we can do is to try and fool the Japanese. He hoped to trick the Japanese into thinking that the base defenses had been so badly damaged by these bombing attacks that there was nothing left there.
So he passed on word that they figured they'd be here, you know, at light, first light. And not a single battery is to fire a shot till I give the order.
You see, they were getting closer and closer to the shore all the time.
Admiral Kajioka opened up from a range of about 7,000 yards with his big guns. And what he proceeded to do was just sort of steam back and forth off the coast of Wake, narrowing the range all the time. And he thought, there's no fire back.
Well, he let them come in and come in and come in, and the guys were getting, when is he going to let us fire?
And they were begging him, you know, let us fire, let us fire. And he kept saying, no, wait, wait. And at 4,000 yards, he gave the order to open fire.
That's when we hammered him.
Every firing battery was laying to good heavy fire on every ship they had out there.
3 days after Pearl Harbor, the Marines and civilians, armed only with 18 light artillery pieces and 24 machine guns, were holding off 14 enemy ships.
Dar, as a contractor, what are you doing during this gunfight?
I'm helping out on Peel Island on the anti-aircraft because we had one sergeant and 12 civilians.
One of the batteries did succeed in sinking one of his destroyers. And basically, the whole crew was lost with it.
Our gun fired and blew him in two.
Admiral Kajioka was just stunned. His ship was riddled with hits. He had to turn tail, losing two ships, almost 400 men, and the embarrassment of being the only Japanese attack in the early part of the war to be turned back by an Allied force.
You guys let out a little cheer when that happened?
Oh, yes. We went apes.
Admiral Kajioka was handed a humiliating defeat by Devereaux's defenders, but the orders from the Imperial High Command were clear. Take the island at any cost. That's next on War Stories.
Now, the men on Wake Island knew, okay, we repulsed them this one time, but they're going to come back. They just didn't know when, for sure.
Though licking their wounds, Admiral Kajioka's aircraft were back the next day.
Pretty much every day except one day, there was a Japanese bombing attack on Wake from December 8th to December 23rd.
At almost 11:30, every day we would be hit. Looked like they were pouring bushels of apples out because the bombs were small. They were incendiary and anti-personnel bombs.
But the Japanese weren't completely alone in the sky. Defending the battered Wake Island airstrip were the four remaining Wildcats. Lieutenant Kinney and the other pilots of VMF 211 took to the air.
I went back up almost every day. There was about six airplanes that I was attacking. The Japs had shot through my goggles. Fortunately, I was safe enough to make another run out. Eventually, we thought maybe somebody would come and and help us.
Everyone assumed the island would either be reinforced or evacuated.
The civilians assumed they would be evacuated because they had been promised that in the case of any kind of difficulty, the government would take care of them. And the Marines just assumed, well, the Navy will be here.
But hope for the beleaguered garrison came on 20 December.
We had a PBY seaplane come in with the messenger.
They told us that there was a convoy, ships coming to evacuate the men and reinforce with more Marines and more airplanes.
On 14 December, the Pacific Fleet Commander dispatched a relief force from Hawaii. But while the convoy was en route, Admiral Kimmel was fired. His temporary successor, Vice Admiral William S. Pai, had second thoughts about the operation.
Pai was thinking, what if the Japanese arrive? What if it runs into Japanese carriers? So does he want to go down as the man who lost the rest of the Navy? Or does he want to be, you know, take the gamble, the man who saved Wake Island? You know, he thought, I can't be a commander who loses the rest of the fleet. Well, he ended up deciding I'd better save the Navy. That was more valuable for the rest of the war effort to keep these ships afloat than to keep Wake Island.
If they came, it'd be good. If they didn't come, you'd do the best you could.
They probably made a good decision. A lot of guys were upset about them not coming.
The men today, they say, we hold no ill will towards anyone. It's the deck of cards we were dealt. We were Marines.
The men were on their own, isolated and desperate, and the Japanese attacks were intensifying.
We were being bombed day and night. They must have orders to take this place regardless of the price.
And then they came in on the 23rd with a vengeance.
From the Marshall Islands, 2,000 men of the Maizuru Special Naval Landing Force sailed toward Wake. On the 23rd of December 1941, they were ordered by Admiral Kajioka to take the island at any cost.
That morning, 42 ships on the horizon. That's a lot of ships. And they were battleships, they were cruisers, they were aircraft carriers, destroyers.
Admiral Kajioka had learned his lessons well from being stung on December 11th. He first of all started his bombardment from a much farther range to soften things up. He wasn't going to let his big ships in within range of those guns on Wake Island.
They'd hit us from the side, from the rear, from the front, and they were well organized.
Early in the morning, maybe been like 2 or 3. The Japanese landed on Wilkes with about a company of men.
The rubber boats started landing on Wilkes first, then on Peel, and then on Wake.
Some of the 50 caliber machine gun people could hear people rushing through the brush by them.
They landed around 3 a.m. and continued fighting for the next 4, 5, 6 hours. And it was basically a last ditch, a last stand kind of a battle.
The odds were against us.
With 1,200 Japanese ashore armed with weapons like this, the Marines have to face the inevitable. That's next on War Stories. 23 December 1941. At 0200, 1,200 Japanese Marines of their Special Landing Force stormed the Wake Island Atoll. The remaining American defenders now faced their toughest battle yet.
John, show me the layout of the defenses of Wake Island by the 23rd.
There was one battery at Peel Island, one at Wake Island, and one at Wilkes Island over here. The Japanese sent two forces here against the southern shoreline. Then a third force of 100 Japanese came in right about the middle of Wilkes Island against the 3-inch guns where you had Jack Skaggs there.
We didn't know how many people they'd put ashore. We could still hear them talking. No American talking, but hear the Japanese talking.
Did any of them come right across the beach there?
We had one of our men kill one. Shot him right in the head.
It came down to waves of attacks by the Japanese. And they'd fight that one off, then another wave.
The man next to me, Ernie Vincent, I had his blood all over me. And I had another guy's blood all over me. And they said, you're hit, Joe. I was hit mostly by coral.
As Kajioka's men swarmed across the island, Commander Cunningham's communications with the rest of the atoll were cut off.
He doesn't know what's going on. One civilian came in and told him they're killing all the civilians.
He assumed, and Major Devereaux did too, the Japanese were succeeding. And so at 5 o'clock, he sent a cable out saying, enemy on island, issue in doubt. About 2 hours later, Cunningham and Devereaux started talking about surrender. Now, the issue of surrender is up to the commanding officer, in this case would be Commander Cunningham. Neither really wanted to be the first to say we should surrender.
Everything fell apart.
Because there was no places to hide.
So Cunningham would say, well, what do you think? And Devereaux would say, well, it doesn't look great, but what do you think? They went back and forth like that a little bit until Cunningham said, I think we better give it over to them. They based that decision on the fact that further fighting would do nothing to stop the Japanese. And so on that reason, they decided to surrender.
Here comes a truck down the road. There's Major Devereaux on there with a white flag. Another officer or two with him said, it's over with. Surrender.
What's going on in your mind when you get the word to surrender?
About the worst day of my life. We dropped our rifles and ammo and went up on the road. At that time, then I saw these two Japanese come up. That's the person that I saw. Had to have the hands up. Everybody had their hands in the air.
Of course, they're all bayonet crazy, you know, rifles with bayonets. They come up to us, and you see there's shaking. So that made us scared, because we didn't want to get stuck, see?
Most of them were taken to the airstrip, where a lot of them were bound up with wire.
They tied us up like this and around our neck and then made to sit down. We just sat down row after row after row.
Lieutenant Kinney, who had been in the hospital, was taken to the airstrip where he was forced to kneel on the hard surface.
When they tied your hands behind your back and around your neck, you have to sort of work your way through so you can get a little slack to keep from choking to death.
Kajioka had lost 850 men to this tiny garrison of U.S. Marines and civilians. With 124 of their comrades killed during the two-week siege, those now facing captivity thought they would be next.
Of course, we thought, first of all, that they're just going to take us out and shoot us.
They had guns aimed in on us. We all felt that that's what we're going to get, a machine gun.
And finally, this little Japanese interpreter got up on a platform and announced something like, Tokyo has demanded that we not kill all of you.
Beaten and bruised, the POWs couldn't know that back home they'd already become legends.
President Roosevelt delivers his message to Congress on the State of the Union.
It was bitter not to be able to relieve the heroic and historic defenders of Wake Island when the survivors of that great fight are liberated and restored to their home. They will learn that 130 million of their fellow citizens have been inspired to render their own full share of service and sacrifice.
America needed heroes, and as FDR spoke, Hollywood was well on its way to producing the first World War II combat film, Wake Island, starring Brian Donlevy and famed character actor William Bendix. After Wake fell, the Japanese raised their flag over the island, and they assessed what to do with American POWs.
They had 1,100 civilian construction workers and, you know, 450 military, and so they had to do something with them.
The Japanese knew the well-trained Marines and highly skilled civilians would be useful as slave labor elsewhere in their empire. As they prepared to ship the men to China, Dar Dodds and Joe Goikachia learned some of their brothers wouldn't be making the trip.
The base facilities hadn't been completed yet, so the Japanese decided to keep the most valuable workers there so that they could finish the work.
Leaving, in the end, 98 Americans behind.
Those skilled men were left on Wake Island.
We didn't know what to think, but it was all bad.
On 12 January 1942, the POWs slated to leave the island were rounded up. This rare photograph from a Japanese propaganda book shows civilian workers being herded aboard the transport ship Nita Maru. Jack Skaggs still has a copy of the regulations he and the rest of the POWs were handed.
These are the orders that each prisoner received prior to being put on the Japanese held ship, the Nita Maru. And the first item: the prisoners disobeying the following orders will be punished with immediate death.
Did they tell you where they were going to take you?
No. The day they put me on the Nita Maru, which was a hell ship, my contract on Wake Island was up that very day.
We knew we were going off the island, and that
Of course, we were very, very disappointed. We went over onto the ship there, and we were met with a long line of Japanese. And you had to run the gauntlet is what it was.
You got beaten well. I got knocked down as well as the fellow next to me, bleeding like a stuck hog. I mean, they were using clubs. Out to sea we go, and we're on our way to Shanghai.
When the battle for Wake Island returns, the grim fate of the 98 American civilians forced to stay behind. January 1942. For 12 days, the Japanese hell ship Nita Maru carried the Wake Island defenders east. Their destination? Japanese-occupied China. And the guards aboard were hell-bent on revenge.
They had clubs, and they'd beat you with the clubs. They beat up almost everybody up.
We never got out of the holds. We stayed in the holds. Of course, as you know, we lost, I think it's 5 men.
They were so built up, so intense on killing your enemy, that these 5 warrant officers that beheaded 5 of our people.
Who did the beheading?
It was enlisted men. It was just a case of showing off their superiority to their people, I suppose. But they never told us about it.
The American POWs arrived in Wusong, China on 24 January 1942.
Just below the boondocks, Shanghai boondocks. We got off there and they walked us to I don't know how many miles, but it's colder than hell.
They joined 203 other Marines captured in North China, and the Japanese made this propaganda film of their arrival. After the brutality of their voyage to China, this speech by Commander Cunningham is particularly unnerving.
Cunningham speaking. I have a message for the President of the United States. In the face of superiority, we were obliged to give up Wake Island. Since our capture, we have been well treated, and I wish to thank the people of the Japanese nation for their consideration.
The camps in China were rough. There were beatings, and there were some deaths.
And a lot of them just took every chance they could to just do you in. Brutal. Brutal as hell.
There was especially one named the Beast of the East, Ishihara. Was very cruel.
The guy that was called the Beast of the East.
He loved to beat on you and call you rotten names.
He beat on you?
One time, across the back. That wasn't a bad one.
With a stick or a
this
club?
Cat of nine tails. It's a big riding crop.
Though beaten day in and day out, the American POWs never lost their honor. War Stories located this 1949 recording of Major James Devereaux as he spoke about their proud defiance in the face of their Japanese captors.
They marched straight out, head up and eyes to the front. I felt my spirit soar. I looked at the Japanese around us. Their faces showed a mixture of admiration and bewilderment. What kind of men were these Americans that they can still keep their courage and self-respect? In the long years to come, they often protested. But you don't act like prisoners. They never understood.
There were a few times that some men were allowed to communicate via mail.
Sergeant Major, what's this right here?
This is a birthday card from my mother, sent to me in prison camp in Shanghai, China. Hope unexpected pleasures combined with work well done will make your service birthday a very pleasant one. This may long be your birthday, and in years to come, I wish you a happy one now. From your mom and Teresa, my sister.
That got through the censors.
Got through the censors.
Much bitter fighting remains to be done, but the beginning has successfully been made.
With the war against the Japanese now in full gear, Wake Island wasn't forgotten. Pan American Airways joined the war effort, utilizing its clippers to transport troops, supplies, and even President Roosevelt to the Casablanca Conference in February of 43.
His first plane trip since becoming president, and the first time that any president while in office has flown.
As MacArthur and Nimitz led the drive to Tokyo, U.S. bombers took aim at the Japanese garrison on Wake, now under the command of Admiral Shikamatsu Sakabara. The 98 American civilians left behind still remained on the island.
J.
John, what happens to the American prisoners left on Wake Island?
They had to endure some of the American bombings on Wake Island. I suppose they looked at it as a positive, even though they could have been killed just as well as a Japanese soldier. And as these bombings became more intensified, the commander, Admiral Sakaibara was his name, felt, I have to retaliate. And this is, he was angry.
On 6 October 1943, Sakaibara exploded in anger and took revenge on the 98 Americans.
He took them down to the beach and had them all gunned down.
Murder by the Japanese.
After 3 years of brutal captivity, Marine aviator John Kinney seizes a chance at freedom aboard a speeding train packed with prisoners.
The train was going 30 to 40 miles an hour. In the dark, you just have to jump out and figure you can make it.
That's next on War Stories. May 1945. It had been 3 long years and 5 months since Wake Island fell, and the captured Americans did everything they could to survive the hell of Japanese POW camps.
Every man wanted to escape, but few really thought they had any possibility of success. Kinney felt it was his duty. I'm going to try to escape. It's just a matter of when can I do it. Well, he had his chance in May of 1945.
They decided to move the people to Japan. So when that happened, four of us had planned to escape.
Fellow Marine Ewing LaPorte rode on the same train.
They moved us to Qingdao, China.
And the train was going 30 to 40 miles an hour. There was two openings in the boxcar. So we decided that we had to use whatever time we had to get out of the boxcar.
Kinney and four others took the chance and jumped.
We didn't know whether we were going to hit another tree or whatever. So we just, in the dark, you just have to jump out and figure you can make it.
The train stopped, and Japanese come pouring into these boxcars, looking around, what have you, cussing, I guess. And we didn't find out until the next day that 5 men escaped.
I was being chased by dogs, other Chinese.
Kinney was separated from the others for a little bit. He made his way to some Chinese and took a chance. You know, you didn't know if you'd be friendly or not friendly. Would they turn you into the Japanese or not?
We were asking Chinese along the way to help us. And most of them would say, you get your head cut off if we help you.
But some Chinese did help. Communist Chinese. With their aid, Kinney traveled over 1,000 miles through China toward freedom. This picture, taken 12 June 1945, shows Kinney with the Chinese who assisted him.
I wanted to get where there are airplanes.
1 month later, the 30-year-old aviator boarded a U.S. Army C-54 in Kunming, China, for the 7-day trip back to Washington, D.C.
I did the best I could, and I came home.
With the Empire under attack from all sides, the Japanese moved Kinney's comrades, still captive, from China into Japan itself. Scattered across the country, the Americans were forced to work under even harsher conditions.
Japan was a lot worse. Another year, I'd never made it.
Joe Goikuchiya slaved 7 days a week in a steel mill outside Tokyo.
Oh, hell, that's terrible. What made it bad was the damn fleas and the lice eating you up. And at night, the rats running over your face. You know, they're hungry, too.
We had a 7-day work week. We worked every day.
This is a picture of Jack Skaggs taken at the Sumaroy prison camp near Osaka, Japan.
I weighed 103 pounds at that time. And then after that, I got beriberi.
Death and disease was rampant. Of the 1,462 Wake Island defenders shipped to camps in the Far East, 231 died in captivity. Those still alive inside Japan were now inadvertently in the crosshairs of Allied bombers.
We were hearing American planes going over all the time.
I was in Tokyo and we were totally blown out. I don't know how many B-29, but big explosions come down.
The Japanese had sat us down one time and said, if you guys think we're going to leave you here to bury us, you're crazy as hell. So that kind of scared us.
We had a man that spoke Japanese pretty well, one of our Marines, and he heard a Japanese guard say that the Americans had dumped tons of gasoline all over the city and then set it on fire. And that was the atomic bomb he's talking about.
They didn't know what it was.
They didn't know what it was.
On the 15th of August, the Emperor of Japan was radioed nationwide, and he said the troops had been ordered to surrender.
And so one night, about 11 o'clock at night, somebody running in the barracks here tells us the damn war is over.
The day Japan surrendered, the Wake Island defenders had spent 1,323 days captive in unimaginable conditions. Many, like Dar Dodds, somehow survived.
How'd you get through it?
I made up my mind I'm going to get home to that wonderful country. So I did.
More on the battle for Wake Island when War Stories returns.
Admiral Sakaibara signs for Japan, yielding Wake Island of historic memory. General Sanderson signs for the United States. And soon afterwards, the Marines bring the American flag back to the island in the far Pacific.
Sakaibara tried to conceal the 1943 murder of the 98 Americans. He scattered the remains throughout the island, an attempt to show they died from American bombs, not Japanese bullets. But dead men can tell tales. And 2 years later, the admiral met his fate in a war crimes trial.
Admiral Sakaibara was executed for slaughtering the civilians in Wake.
And after almost 4 years, the POWs returned to a changed America.
We saw our first woman Marine. We didn't have any women Marines, so things had changed a lot in those 4 years.
Did you see the movie Wake Island?
Yes, they had a special showing for us while we had our first convention in December of 1945. Then we decided maybe we were heroes.
Horrible. The actors that's in it and the story it tells, it is not right.
Do you have a certain sense of pride that they'd made a movie about you?
Yeah, I did. I did have. I just felt that the producer should have got a hold of some Marines to help him make the movie.
What is the legacy of Wake Island?
That heroes come in unexpected places and unexpected forms. They're average, ordinary Americans doing what they have to do.
I think we did an awful good job for what we had there.
Let us know that the Americans will fight when they have to fight, and they got great pride in their country.
The heroic defense of Wake Island was a dramatic boost to American morale in those dark days of December 1941. Though outnumbered, outgunned, and eventually overwhelmed, the tiny garrison inspired the nation. The 16-day battle proved to many that America, fighting virtually alone in the Pacific, could indeed beat the mighty Empire of Japan. At Wake, a small band of warriors had stalled the Japanese rampage through the Pacific and aroused a sleeping giant. Theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. I'm Oliver North. Good night.